This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. America's national debt is out of control, and it's growing, and it could get even bigger under a President Trump. Some say that's not a big deal. That's fine. Trumpet writer Robert Morley says, don't kid yourself. We're going to talk to Robert about what we might expect from a Trump presidency and how debt really is a danger. What is fake news? We're hearing this term bandied about. It's being used to tar a lot of news sources out there. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about why this accusation is being leveled, how we're all subject to confirmation bias in the news we read, and how we, even at the Trumpet, we have to watch out for it. Young people are disenchanted with current politics. It's not hard to understand why when you look at the problems besieging our world today. But what are their solutions? More and more of them are ready to discard political traditions like representative government, democratic ideals, even individual rights, in order to embrace some terrible alternatives. Trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau says this is a major problem that develops when you don't study history. And our young people are not studying history. I'll conclude the program by encouraging you to build more fire and force in your life and to think big. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Under President George W. Bush, America's national debt went from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. Under President Barack Obama, it went from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. Well, what might happen under President Donald Trump? And what difference does it make? To answer these questions, we have Trumpet writer Robert Morley. Hello, Robert.
Hi, good to be here.
Let's just talk about the magnitude of America's debt. What do these numbers mean? We're in $20 trillion range, but in a lot of ways that doesn't even tell the whole story. Maybe you can just help us to understand just how indebted America really is.
Sure. Once you get beyond the million-dollar range, maybe in my case even lower than that, the numbers start to lose meaning in terms of what they mean for the economy. One way that you could look at it maybe is breaking down to the national debt. What does each person in the United States owe? What would be their share of the debt? Just to give a little context to those numbers. When you look at the debt that way, it turns out that the individual citizen of the United States, man, woman, child, each owe collectively or individually approximately $61,000. So each person in the United States, their share of the debt is $61,000. Now, that sounds pretty big in and of itself, but when you really start thinking about what that means in terms of people's ability to pay back that or America's ability to pay back that, the numbers get even more stark and dramatic, because there's no way that, you know, your son or daughter, you know, today, right now, is able to make payments on that debt. So another way that you could look at it would be in what is a debt per taxpayer or someone who's actually paying taxes in the United States. When you look at it that way, the number jumps up to somewhere around $161,000. So tack on an extra $100,000 to the individual taxpayers debt. That's their share, taxpayer burden of just the federal debt. So that's just the federal debt. We aren't even talking about state debt or, you know, municipal debt or the promises made with Medicare or Medicaid. I mean, when you start adding those numbers on, the numbers grow pretty quickly.
Okay. Do you have any idea of what, somebody has done the math to try to calculate what the actual debt is?
Sure. So when you start adding those things, you add on an additional, the $20 trillion federal debt that we have right now to the federal government. You can tack on about another $3 trillion for state and municipal debt. And then with the state and municipal debt, that's probably about another $25,000 per taxpayer in this country. Then you can start taking a look at corporate debt in America. You start throwing that in, we're up to probably about $61 trillion in the United States. And then just going beyond that, what really starts to blow the numbers out, and this is kind of the third rail in politics, nobody wants to touch this, but this is the liabilities, the promises made to Medicare and Medicaid. And when you look at those numbers, they just go through the roof what politicians have promised. And if you want an idea on that, Boston University professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, he does the numbers on that. He's kind of made that his thing. And depending on some of the assumptions that you use in the model, you can get ranges from anywhere from $100 trillion to $200 trillion or more. Now, obviously, these are amounts that will never, ever be paid. Mm-hmm. $200 trillion is just beyond the ability of America to pay. I mean, we have our economy is approximately $19 trillion. The GDP of the United States is about $19 trillion. That's the total amount of goods and services and products produced by the entire nation in a year is $19 trillion. And we're talking about, we've made promises and current debt taken together of maybe up to $200 trillion. Something's going to happen there. It's not going to be paid. And I think most people looking at these numbers realize that. The questions are just who isn't going to get paid.
Right. Yeah, that is the question, is to whom is this money owed? Now, obviously, we're very comfortable being in debt on every level, personally, state, federal government, businesses, corporate entities, everybody. We're fine with it, apparently. Otherwise, we wouldn't have racked those kinds of numbers up, right? So what are we missing here? Like, what difference does debt make? There are a lot of people who say, well, it's fine. It's actually, debt is what makes the economy work.
Well, you're right. Some very preeminent individuals believe that debt is not only acceptable, it's a good way of growing the economy. And if you look at what's happened since the 2008 economic recession, the debt levels have started growing again. We had this massive wipeout that was, in part caused by too much debt with the housing bubble. We had this, this day of reckoning. And then
we solved it with more debt.
And everywhere you look in the economy, student loan debt, car loan debt, they're both over $1 trillion now. I mean, this is what has underpinned America's recovery. So we have a lot of very smart people out there that say, hey, the solution to our problems, the solution to economic woes in this country is more debt. And there's a lot of people, including New York Times columnists, that promote this, and including two presidential candidates and now one president-elect of the United States that feel that the solution to America's problems is increasing the debt, increasing spending.
Does anybody say that the problem is too much debt?
Yes, but they aren't the people in power. And I think part of that is because when you have the reins of power, the easy thing is to spend money. Nobody wants to stop spending money. Nobody wants to pay back something that some previous politician promised or laid out. And because the reality is you start paying back money, you start taking money out of the economy, mm-hmm. you start having to reduce your standard of living, nobody likes that. No politician who wants votes likes that. Mm-hmm. So we're stuck in the cycle that just the debt grows.
So what are those who say that debt is good missing? I guess today the Fed is proposing to raise interest rates. This is something that even if they raise it a fraction of a percent, is something that starts to have some pretty massive ripple effects through the economy.
Yeah, first of all, I think we have to look at the Fed's decision to potentially raise interest rates on Wednesday. They've said if they do raise it, which it looks like they very well might do that, it'll be very small, very measured. They've raised it so far 0.25% in the last 10 years. So this will be an additional 0.25%. So half a point in 10 years they've raised interest rates. So the Fed itself, don't look at this as a signal from the Fed that debt is bad, we want to raise interest rates, make the cost of borrowing more expensive for people. I think you have to look at the Fed decision to raise interest rates in light of them trying to maintain some semblance of credibility in international markets. You have to look at it in terms of them wanting the ability to cut rates when the next recession hits. And we are overdue for that. And I think they're getting a little worried about that. So there's a lot of other reasons that they could be raising interest rates. But I'm glad you brought that out, because in an economy that hinges on debt, if we are in a rising interest rate environment now, interest rates have gone down generally for the past 35 years, kind of like a staircase up and down a little bit, but they've trended down for 35 years. If we're at a point now where they have hit bottom and we're starting to inflect on the way back up now, that has a lot of implications for an economy that's built on debt. Because if the cost of debt starts going up, everything slows down. Everything starts grinding to a halt. And you know what? These last few weeks, we've really seen that in the bond market. We've seen the bond market get hammered. You know, these last couple of months, from the time period leading up to the election and actually particularly after the election, we've seen investors yanking money from bonds. And we're seeing yields go up on bonds because investors are worried that interest rates are going to be rising. So going forward, you know, this does have implications for everything in the mortgage market to lending, to industry, to manufacturing, to personal finance, to credit cards. I mean, you name it, America runs on debt.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about Donald Trump, because he's a businessman. He's used debt to his advantage, and he's made several statements as he was campaigning for the presidency that seemed to indicate his comfort level with debt. He said maybe it's a little different on the national level, but what have you seen in terms of what you might expect under a Trump presidency?
Well, first of all, I think a Trump presidency versus a Hillary Clinton presidency may not have been too different. The one thing, though, that Trump did come out and make very clear was, as much as Hillary Clinton wanted to spend money, for example, on infrastructure, he wanted to spend more. You know, she came out with $250 billion. He said, "I'm going to spend $500 billion." Later on in other interviews, the number seemed to grow towards maybe, you know, even $1 trillion on infrastructure spending. But in terms of debt, I mean, Donald Trump probably is the single most comfortable president probably that's ever existed, who has as comfortable with using debt as any of them, probably more so. And on his disclosures when he was running for the office, I think he disclosed that his companies had about, I think it was a little less than $300 million worth of debt. $300 million. Now that doesn't sound like a lot, and incidentally, Donald Trump himself personally has no debt. He has no debt personally, but companies that he controls, that he owns, they have debt. And the numbers he disclosed on his filings were just companies that he is 100% owner of. The companies he is 100% owner of have about $300 million worth of debt. New York Times dug a little deeper and found companies that he's partial owner of, even majority owner of, and those numbers start soaring very, very rapidly up and towards, you know, $1 billion worth of debt. And for example, one building that he owns in New York has a loan on it an entity in China provided, and the loan on the mortgage on that building is about $900 million. So you start adding up, and he owns multiple buildings or is partial owners in multiple pieces of real estate, some of the best real estate in the United States, including, you know, he has leases on government land as well. And he owes money on things like that too, even to the federal government. So he is certainly comfortable with debt. If you look at statements he has made, I mean, he has not hid this at all. You know, when his enemies accused him of being the debt king, he came out and said, "Yes, I am the king of debt." You know, those are his own words. "I am the king of debt. I have used debt. I've used it very, very well. I love debt." That's another quote from him. "I love debt." And he's just talking about his ability to have, he has used debt in the past to create a lot of wealth for himself. That's reality. That's a fact. That can be fact-checked, but he is very, very comfortable with it. And I think it also gives an indicator of what he'll do as president.
Okay, having that kind of a track record as a businessman, what else would we look at in terms of forecasting what we might expect to see? He's made a lot of promises about infrastructure. You mentioned $500 billion price tag that he'd like to throw at our bridges and roads and those types of things. Anything else that kind of gives us an indication of just how ambitious he would be and how much debt would factor into that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the infrastructure number you mentioned, $500 billion, I expect we'll see that grow. President Obama himself spent about $800 billion on infrastructure, and I think that the return that America got on that was very, very low. I think if he wants to really impact and stimulate the economy, he's going to have to go a lot bigger than that. Just because we have reached this point in America where we've hit this law of diminishing returns on debt. You know, there was a time when America had low levels of debt. It didn't take a lot of extra debt to boost the economy. But now we just have so much debt already. all these added increments of deficit spending just don't impact the way they have in the past. So I think we're going to have numbers much larger than $500 billion going forward. The other thing we need to watch is Trump's talked a lot about if we get into trouble with too much debt, we'll just renegotiate. He's also said, hey, we live in a country that can print money. If we need to, we can refinance our debt is how we call it. We can refinance it. We can take a look at our long-term debt. We'll just print up some money, borrow some money short-term from the Federal Reserve, basically printing money, and we'll pay off the long-term debt with this, you know, lower-yielding short-term debt. So when we start talking about doing things like that, if that actually takes place, if he actually does push through some of those things, and those are the kinds of crazy things that, you know, banana republics around the world do when they get into debt trouble, and America's heading that way, once we start reaching that point, then we start having credibility issues. You know, what is our money worth? What is the confidence in the system? And I think those will be the questions that Americans will be facing, and investors around the world will be facing at that point. And then we get into a whole host of other issues.
It seems like Mr. Trump he's the kind of fellow who savors the art of the deal, and he wants to be the one to kind of do this, make these kinds of deals that demonstrate his prowess in the negotiating room and so on. But there is a point when the debtor or the one who is in debt doesn't have really any more negotiating room. I mean, where does it lead to eventually?
Yeah, that's right. That's a great point. And when we do get to the point where we're printing money to refinance our debt, you know, we take on those kind of debt levels, which we could be within this next presidency. If he goes 4 years, particularly if he, you know, take out these spending proposals, Brookings Institute looked at those and said Trump's probably going to add another $10 trillion to the debt.
You know, one term?
Well, they said it would be like over his two terms. Like if he were to go another one, if you'd extend that out 8 to 10 years, we'd have at least another $10 trillion added on there. So we start projecting those kind of numbers out, and then we start considering we may be in a rising interest rate environment. The payments on the national debt start to blow out every other line item on the government's balance sheet, and we start getting into very, very serious situations.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Robert Morley about America's national debt, what might happen to it over the next 4 years or however long it might take to get to those kind of levels that you're describing. He's writing an article about this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Robert.
You're more than welcome.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A new term has entered public discussion, fake news. During America's presidential campaign, Donald Trump repeatedly called out the mainstream media for being biased and left-leaning, and Americans loved it. They obviously agreed with him. Public confidence in the media is at an all-time low. Well, now the mainstream media are fighting back. They're actually saying that Mr. Trump was elected in part because of alternative news sources that don't have the same rigorous standards of truth-telling that they have. This is a really interesting discussion going on about how we consume news, what constitutes real news in today's internet-driven world. And to talk about this, we have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So what do they mean by fake news?
Well, that's actually a complex part of this story. What do you mean by fake news? Because there is actual fake news out there. There are plenty of false publications that peddle. They expressly fabricate stories that are 100% disinformation. And these are just, they're able to attract a lot of clickbait by, you know, falsifying an entire story that takes place in an American city that doesn't actually exist, narrated by a sheriff that doesn't actually exist. You know, these are the stories that a lot of mainstream media right now are pointing to when they talk about fake news. They're pointing to really just absolute fabrications. But the problem is that once you really begin to flesh out the idea of what fake news can mean, if you push some of these mainstream sources, wait a minute, so what exactly do you mean by fake news? You realize that the definition can be loosened. It can be broadened. It can really begin to encompass a publication that may lean a little more to the right than they would like it to. And the problem is, you know, who do you allow to define fake news once you loosen that definition? I completely agree that those publications that just unabashedly falsify and fabricate stories, you know, making up cities and people, there's no use for that in a media that's to value the citizenry of any kind. But the trouble is, once you really push and see that their definition is looser and broader than that, then there begins to be a bit of debate. Who's to determine whether Bloomberg or Breitbart or, you know, InfoWars sometimes, whether that's fake or not. With certain publications, they may have some stories that are well-researched, well-grounded in factual reality, and then others that are not. With other publications, every single story could be totally false. It just becomes very murky.
And the ones who are making these charges, we've heard Hillary Clinton say this, that this is a real danger. We've heard other prominent politicians. President Obama came out with a statement the other day saying, well, you know, we really have to put a high value on the truth and this type of thing. You also have publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post who are calling out some of these what they call fake news sources. And they're really putting quite a few different fairly popular media outlets and news outlets under that umbrella, aren't they?
That's right. Yeah, it really seems like anyone who doesn't toe sort of the MSM, you know, the mainstream media line, could easily earn themselves a place on that list.
And so, practically speaking, this actually could have ramifications as to whether those sources that are tarred with that brush are able to reach their audiences, or to at least extend beyond those who are already kind of their established base, by virtue of their being eliminated from aggregators like Google and other places online that basically point people to news sources.
Yeah, one of the main calls right now is for Facebook's Zuckerberg, I think, to begin to implement some algorithms and some filtering, you know, services that would prevent users of Facebook, you know, from seeing a lot of these types of stories. So it really would, like you said, I don't think they would take away those who are already going directly to those websites. But what it would do is, if those calls are if it comes to fruition, I guess, then it could prevent Facebook from disseminating certain stories.
So this is, we didn't hear about this until after the election. And it was really, it seems like, in response to the amazing fail that the mainstream media had. They were just absolutely certain that the election was in the bag for Hillary Clinton. When they were proved wrong, then it seems like a lot of this has come into reaction to that. What's your read on how much this is essentially the mainstream media who are looking at the landscape of news today and how much it has changed from the days of, you know, when they had something of a monopoly? The New York Times dictated what the stories of the day was. The big three television networks would kind of follow their line. Now we're in the Wild West, and there's news sources all over the place that are, they'll report whatever they want to with whatever slant they want. There's a lot of gray area between news and opinion. How much is this the mainstream media trying to reclaim their territory?
I think that's a really big part of it. And I think that's, you know, shameful, really, that once they were exposed for having had a lot of very partisan reporting in the lead up to the election. You know, we saw the Huffington Post say on election day that Hillary Clinton had a, I think it was a 98.2% chance of winning. And they pointed to these very complex projection models and polls and all this proof of why she could not lose. And it was the same thing with the Times. Their number was the New York Times. Their number was a little bit more modest, but I think it was still in the high 80s or low 90s. And so there was a big media bubble. They had sort of worked to create this reality where Trump couldn't really win. All of his supporters were a bunch of white supremacists, basically, that were destined to be kind of steamrolled by the progressives. But that was a false narrative that so many journalists and publications and outlets had worked to create. And so then, around midnight that night, when that whole narrative was revealed to be false by the fact that Trump won the vote, that bubble sort of burst. And there was a lot of embarrassment, but there was not that much contrition, right, and repentance. Instead, what you saw was a lot of deflecting of blame. Suddenly, instead of saying, well, we were sorry, we really got caught up in our own story, we really started to believe our own propaganda, in a sense, instead of that, they said, a lot of these big sources said, this is the fault of the alternative right and fake news stories and publications that should never have been allowed to print their message, yeah, but their message did get out there and it stole this vote away from us. So to me, it was a bizarre response to that, just an utter refusal to take blame for what really was biased reporting on the part of a lot of MSM, and just this strange attempt to deflect it on fake news.
So I'd like to get back to just the richness of the fact that it was really a lot of what you could call fake news happening on the part of the left media that led to that revelation on election night, that caused them and provoked them to try to make these charges against the right. But let's just focus on how much truth is there in their claims? Because you mentioned that there are these sites out there that are completely fabrication, but you also have quite a lot of sites where there is a mix of, you know, basically objectivity just seems to have less and less value in today's news reporting. And a lot of people, they want this sort of edgy, opinion-based information. And a lot of that, the political right definitely is producing a lot of that. I'm just wondering how much truth is there in the claims. It seems like there's enough that it doesn't, you can't just dismiss what the New York Times and Washington Post are saying here.
I agree. I think that there is quite a lot of that. And also in this internet age where people can curate their own news feeds, right, you sign up for which emails you want to receive. You follow which Twitter accounts you feel are giving you a message that you like. You do the same thing with Facebook and Google and everything else. And so what happens is people very often on the left and the right, people curate their feeds in a way that it becomes an echo chamber. They only hear what they want to hear. They only receive stories that confirm their view. If Trump is a terrible person, they want to, you know, subscribe to the sites that reinforce that view over and over. If they believe that the Clintons have had a legacy of scandal and abuse of power, they'll curate their feeds in a way that does that. And there are so many sites on the internet, you know, so many. It's a shocking number. And I think every month, hundreds and hundreds more little sites are popping up. It's impossible to keep up with it all. But there's no shortage of places to go. If you want to hear your own beliefs echoed and reinforced, just do a couple of Google searches and you'll find some publication that, you know, ranging from moderately right to about as far right as you want to go. And the same on the other end of the spectrum too.
Right. Yeah. It really does go both ways. And I mean, the way that the press built up a Hillary Clinton victory was a fantastic example of just how susceptible the mainstream media is to it. As much as they want to present themselves as being this repository of objectivity, they have the same tendency toward confirmation bias that those on the right do. And so it really does pose the question, how do you kind of draw back from that and really have a truth-based read on what's happening in the world? I'm reminded of this. I actually pulled up this little article that somebody sent me a little while ago from The Onion. Now, this is fake news. This is objectively by every measure, and it's intended to be humorous. Fake news, but this the headline was Facebook user verifies truth of article by carefully checking it against own preconceived opinions. It says, explaining that people need to be critical of the news stories that circulate on social media these days, area Facebook user James Wheatley, 44, reportedly took the time to verify the truth of an article he came across Thursday by carefully checking it against the opinions he already holds. You can't just accept everything you see online, which is why I take a closer look at the claims that are made in every article and make sure that each one of them is backed up by my existing assumptions and personal feelings about the world, this individual said. That's great stuff.
It's brilliant. Yeah. And that's the reason why it's brilliant is because it perfectly describes how a great number of Americans and people around the world consume their news. If they feel that a story disagrees with their beliefs, they're quick to say, well, this is not a publication I trust. I think there's some dereliction of duty on the editorial board there, and I reject this.
Yeah. Well, now, we're all susceptible to it, and I would not accept the trumpet from that. It's just the way that human beings tend to think. But you having served as the head of our fact-checking department for how many years did you do that, Jeremiah?
I think it was around five.
Yeah, okay.
Give or take.
So you were continually looking at the things that we were writing and trying to verify all of our assertions, everything that we said against multiple sources, and amending language, trying to remove inherent bias and to expose things that didn't belong there. It's a difficult process, but we do take our role seriously as in reporting the news to try to be accurate and truthful in everything that we're saying.
That's exactly right. Yes, our editor in chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has I believe it was him that established the fact-checking department just to try to put kind of a safety net on the automatic confirmation bias and blind spots that every person in the world, including those writing for the Trumpet, can sometimes have. So it was it's a rewarding job, but quite a demanding one to go through and make sure, okay, that is what other sources say, and these other sources, in my view, are credible enough to be able to put the check mark by that. So,
right.
Yeah, it's a tall order sometimes,
but I guess more broadly, the fact that we are really trying to avoid looking at things from a partisan standpoint and look at things from a prophetic standpoint. I mean, that definitely is a bias in the sense that we're evaluating what's important, what's happening in the world through that lens of what the Bible prophesies and seeing how those things confirm those prophecies. But it is extraordinary how good of a means of evaluating what's happening in the world that really is. It gives you a tremendous amount of insight into the real importance of this trend versus that trend.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We you know, view the headlines through that lens of those events that we know are prophesied to happen in numerous biblical passages. And so it may make us not that excited about stories that other publications feel is a big deal. And then it would make us call a great deal of attention to what other publications may feel is sort of a minor event.
It also tends to be pretty unpopular because what we're writing doesn't necessarily confirm any of the biases on either side of the political spectrum when it comes to a particular country. We went pretty hard after President Obama for a lot of reasons because of the prophecies that he fulfilled, and we've started to evaluate Mr. Trump's moves against that same standard. And there are people that don't like it because they perceive it just as critical of him personally. But I guess that's the risk that you take.
Yeah, that's right. I think during the 8 years of the Obama administration, maybe some of our readers began to think that we, you know, in some ways might have been good Republicans because we would, you know, expose some of the problems with that administration. But now suddenly when we have President-elect Trump waiting in the wings there and they see that we are also pointing to potential problems with him, they realize, wait a minute, these guys are not Republican. They're not left or right. This is really an apolitical publication. And so it doesn't win us a lot of friends among partisans on either side, really.
Right. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about fake news and confirmation bias in reading the news. He's working on an article on this subject, really interesting subject. You can watch for that in the coming weeks on thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We're in a time of real political upheaval. We're seeing the rise of populist-type leaders like Donald Trump. People are coming to embrace more and more authoritarian-type leadership. We saw that even with Barack Obama in this country. Socialist Bernie Sanders got a whole lot of support, especially among younger people. The Democratic Party is becoming more radicalized. This is happening in America. It's happening in other nations as well. And it's especially notable to look at the political tendencies among younger people. They're quite a bit more radical than older generations. In an article he's just written, trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau identifies a cause for this willingness of younger people to break from past political traditions. And that is they just don't know about history. They're ignorant about history. We have Abraham here to talk about this. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. So let's talk first about just how far younger people are departing from principles of democracy and some of the traditions, just within America, that have really built this nation politically.
Sure. So there's been a release of some statistics. And they have revolved around millennials. So those are people born in the 1980s, 1990s. And these statistics, they just measure how people view democracy, how they view civil rights, how they view the Constitution, how they view very vital parts of American democracy. And this was written by a Harvard University researcher and a political scientist from the University of Melbourne. And this study is called The Danger of Deconsolidation, and the statistics show that in a high minority, so in about a quarter of millennials in some cases, they don't value democracy, and in fact, they favor undemocratic governments instead of the American democracy we have. And some examples of that are that only 19% of millennials in the study object to a military coup if it was to happen in the United States. 43% of older Americans object to it. So that's still not a high amount either. But
so 19% say we would be opposed to a military coup. So you're talking about 81% who are ambivalent or supportive of a military takeover of the United States.
That's correct.
That's shocking.
Yeah, only 19% would be strongly opposed. In other words, they would take violent means or just extreme action to stop it. And considering why America was founded on the experience of the founding fathers who were striving against the tyranny, it's surprising to see that only not even 20% of millennials would object to a Caesar coming and taking away American democracy.
Okay, so they're fine, or I guess at least not violently opposed or strongly opposed to a military takeover? What are some of the other ideas that they've kind of warmed up to?
Sure. Yeah. One of the more surprising ones is that only about 30% of millennials see the civil rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution as essential to American democracy. And that one's, I think, one of the most disturbing, is that 70% of millennials don't see the civil rights as important. And those are all the rights to guarantee voting, our freedoms to be able to speak our mind, worship the God that we choose, and all these things that are really the foundation of American character. Only 30% view them as important to democracy.
You're really talking about an effect of students growing up on an education system that prioritizes safe spaces and preventing people from offending one another over free expression of ideas and those freedoms that you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like a lot of young people would rather have no rights in order to be safe or to avoid discomfort or attacks or the microaggressions, as we've seen over the last couple of years. They'd rather just have all those privileges revoked rather than living with the some of the unfortunate trials that come with living in an open society.
Free society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another one, which is really a poor showing of America as well, is that nearly 25%, so a quarter of young Americans, believe that democracy is a bad or a very bad way to run the United States. And that's a significant increase from 1995 when the same metric was taken.
So now, when you say democracy, are you just talking about like having the right to vote and to have a say? I mean, I guess the word democracy is a little bit loose, and the United States was certainly founded on democratic principles and democratically elected representation. What is it exactly that they say is such a disaster?
The main thing they were measuring here is how people agree with having representative officials and basically just voting for your leaders. The same study showed that a lot of millennials aren't as opposed to having specialists rule over them, so like bureaucrats, technocrats, or just they don't think elections are that important to democracy or just to national livelihood. So that the one quarter who believe democracy is a bad way, it's either an indication of people who don't want to vote for their elected officials, or they're just become disaffected with how the American system is run. They become distanced from the American voting process.
Well, in a lot of ways, I can understand. there's a lot to be disenfranchised about with the way that the politics run today. Just with this last election, it seemed like there was just a really high a percentage of voters who kind of had a none of the above approach going into it. I could see that turning off a lot of younger people. But in your article, you really draw attention to the absence of history being taught in our schools as being a major cause for some of this upheaval in political reason that we are seeing among younger people. There obviously be a lot of causes, and we kind of have intimated a couple of them, but what is it about the teaching of history or the lack of history being instructed like it should be that you think is a major cause?
Right. Yeah, there's this trend is not monocausal. There's family breakdown, economic means. There's tons of different factors. But the main one with history is that it's a direct correlation in data. We can actually look at graphs, data, and see that there's also a decline in important history being taught at schools, as the increase in millennials being disaffected with democracy. So there's a direct correlation in the numbers, which is a hard proof that there's something related between the two. And I think if you even look at what the millennials are thinking about, that they would be okay with a military coup, that they don't want democracy, they don't view the civil rights as important. all these things, I believe, are just a sign of ignorance, a dangerous ignorance. That why do people, why do a large minority want or wouldn't be opposed to a military coup? Well, do they know what a military coup is? Do they know the history of military coups, the violence it brings, the right. disorder? And so I think people, they don't, they've had a lot of bad experience with democracy. As you mentioned, even this last election, a very poor showing of the principles of America and what America is capable of really the worst that we've seen. And so look, they're looking for an alternative to that. And the alternatives they look to aren't any better than democracy because they don't know the history behind those alternatives. And I think that's the danger is when, or part of it is that when you, you teach the evils of democracy or, mm-hmm. or the mistakes made, which are important to know, but you don't show the benefits mm-hmm. of democracy, how good America has been to the world on a whole in this, if you weigh the America in the balance, and then you start looking to these alternative regimes like socialism, like military coup in an extreme example. But when you look at that history, there's some of the worst and most brutal dictatorships history has ever recorded. And if people are ignorant of that, they're not going to know what their decisions will bring upon themselves and their own nation.
You know, I'm even thinking you don't have to look that far back in history in order to see just how dangerous government can be when it's unrestrained. And you look at the, well, say you take the words of like an Alexander Solzhenitsyn or someone who lived underneath the Soviet dictatorship, when they would look at America and to hear about the kind of freedoms that Americans enjoyed, it was just like, that was Shangri-La. That was utopia, you know? And for Americans to never see the other side, you end up with, say, these ignorant students that you're talking about saying, well, yeah, North Korea would actually be pretty nice place to visit. Or I saw an interview, somebody was just going around a college campus saying, well, who's worse or who's better, Donald Trump or Fidel Castro? And these students had a real hard time. And a lot of them said, well, I think Castro is a better leader than Donald Trump is, just because of it was a real strong indication of just how much they've heard on the bad side of just on one side of the argument.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I think that's a great indication of how education is in history in any, part of American education, but especially in history, where we see the enemies of America praised, or the ideologies that have opposed America praised or glorified, and you see the American system degraded. And a lot of that that comes from how history is being taught, the minds behind who's teaching the history, and just that the taking away of the history that's really important. They're really substituting the important history, the things that talking about the men who made America great, talking about the miracles and a lot of the inspiring history of America. They're replacing that with other history, which has its place, but it isn't as important as that history. And just some examples here. It's really fascinating that at America's top universities, and this is from Neil Ferguson gave a speech in October, talking about this problem, and he listed some examples of the type of history courses a young American could find if they want to major in history at a university. And he used examples from Harvard, Yale, and Stanford. And these are some examples of history classes. Harvard has one called Emotions in History, and it studies the history of emotion, the subjectivity of history. And it uses case studies from Australia.
Now, I apologize for laughing.
Oh, well, it's hard not to laugh though.
It's not exactly the kind of history that your dad took or your grandpa took.
Yeah, exactly. And he points out there's a total enrollment of one in the class.
Well,
so
that's
far.
That's positive news.
Yeah, yeah, but you can see that.
This is really some information that you have in this article. It's pretty fascinating to see just this sea change from away from hard intellectual type courses toward these soft social sciences and study of feminization and catering to minority groups and that type of thing. Massive, massive change in what students are receiving in a liberal arts education today.
Yeah, exactly. There's some great numbers from the American History Association. They've been publishing a lot of great reports documenting this. And just in some examples of the soft sciences becoming very dominant in or more dominant in history faculties at major universities. Just some examples are history studies regarding women and gender. They've increased 797%.
That's a lot.
In the last 30 years. That's a huge amount. and so they instead of being 1% of a faculty, they're now 10%. And then you still factor in history revolving around the environment, race and ethnicity. All those have increased substantially, where you're having history professors who would teach classic history subjects like diplomatic history, economic history, basically the history of Western civilization. They're being replaced with teachers who are very specialized. And while it's great to know those subjects, it's good to be well-read and to have a broad view of history. If a subject is too specialized, you don't understand its relevance to everything else. Mm-hmm. And some of the courses offered are so specialized that their importance is almost non-existent, like learning about witchcraft in colonial America. It's fascinating. I'm sure it's exciting for those taking it. But how does that go to explaining the American Revolution, the American Civil War, the U.S. Constitution? It doesn't fit into any of those things. Mm-hmm. And so students are having a hard time finding classes that will teach them about the core values of America. And part of the reason is that because the faculty aren't offering those classes, and mm-hmm. They don't believe in those core values of America.
You made a great point earlier that I just wanted to finish with. You were talking about just if you're not aware of the dangers in some of these other systems of government, the dangers of military coup, the dangers in dictatorship, then you can if you can just look at the problems associated with the system that we've got and say, well, just about anything would be better than this. And why don't we try some of these other things? Well, those things have been tried. And it was actually because of that, that the founders of America established the system that they did. I was actually reading earlier in the week about William Penn and the laws that he established in Pennsylvania initially. And he makes a fantastic point in this essay that it's the information that precedes the specific laws that he put in place in Pennsylvania when it was a colony. But he said, look, if you have good leaders, then the system itself is far less important. If good men will make it work, and if you have evil leaders, even if it's a good system, they're going to find a way to twist it to their ends. And I thought, well, that really is a profound point. The thing about the American system is that its genius was really in limiting the damage that a bad leader can do. You know, if you have a good king, you know, you're going to have happy people. A good king can have a monarchy can be wonderful for the people. But what happens when you get a bad king? It's an absolute disaster. The American system established a way that to preserve the freedoms, the liberty of the individuals within the system, even if you get some bad leaders in power. And it's our departure from some of those checks that they put in place in order to prevent that kind of tyranny that has established the problems that that's the reason for a lot of the problems that we see today. But to throw those things out and to put our lot in and basically say, well, we want something more akin to a monarchy. You get a bad king in there and you have a terrible situation on your hands. And these kids that haven't looked back at the history, they don't recognize just what a privilege it has been to grow up under a system that protected them in the way that it did.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. Just that the American government is meant to limit the poor effects of human nature that its leaders can have on the people. And that if people have a problem with democracy, choosing another form of government is only aiding those who are hurting them because the civil rights that millennials don't really care for, or high minority of them don't, those are the things that guarantee that those leaders they don't like can't hurt them to right. the extent that Mao could, Fidel Castro could, Stalin could. And so especially with communism and the far left getting control of American academia during the Cold War, and we're seeing the effects of that today, if students learn the history of communism, especially, they would realize that the American Constitution is one of the few written documents that is designed to stop that from happening and to prevent the terrible atrocities that every communist state has fallen into in all of history.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau. He's written an article called The War on History. It's up right now on thetrumpet.com. It's a really fascinating subject, Abraham. We thank you for writing that and bringing it to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It's time for today's last word.
The city of Chicago is an architectural wonder. Towering, sleek, modern skyscrapers of steel and glass fill the sky. Wedged between them, unapologetic and unintimidated, stand stunning older structures of ornately carved stone. The city silently tells thousands of stories of bold men who dreamed and built and achieved great things. "Make no little plans," said Daniel Burnham. This was one of Chicago's early architects. "They have no magic to stir men's blood and probably themselves will not be realized. Make big plans. Aim high in hope and work, remembering that a noble logical diagram once recorded will never die, but long after we are gone will be a living thing, asserting itself with ever-growing insistency. Let your watchword be order and your beacon beauty. Think big." Isn't that just the way God thinks? Look at the size of the universe. Isaiah 9 says the increase of God's government will never end, and because God is so zealous, he'll make sure of it. He's a big thinker. We have to challenge our own mental smallness and train ourselves to expand our plans like God. Big thinking inspires and demands vigorous action. Amid a spiritual revival among the early American colonists, there was a minister named George Whitefield. He bestrode the scene. This is how another man described him. He lived. Other men seemed to be only half alive, but Whitefield was all life, fire, wing, force. That description also applied beautifully to Herbert W. Armstrong. His autobiography hums with vigorous life and force. He wrote, "There was always a sense that I had to hurry. I was learning to plunge into a task with dynamic energy." When he was almost 83 years old, he wrote this, "There's no question I'm asked more often, it seems, than what is the secret of your long life, youthful vitality, energy, and drive?" He was 83. Evaluate yourself. Are you really maximizing the physical life and mental capacity God has given you? Or have you allowed yourself to be trapped, to be small and narrow, timid and dull? Mr. Armstrong once had a temporary job at a small class journal. He recognized potential for this job to become a far more important position, so he worked really hard and exploited that potential. That big thinking led him to establish a successful business of national scope right in bustling Chicago. And he wrote this in his autobiography. "This is the quality rare among people, but why should it be, called vision. Most men are never able to see any possibilities of expanding their present jobs. They do merely what they are told, what someone higher up thought out and laid before them. They never think out ways to do the job better, or to develop or expand their own job into something bigger, or to be preparing themselves for the better jobs and promotions to them. The application of some of these principles makes all the difference between employee and employer, between mediocrity or failure and success. Think about your roles in life: husband, wife, student, parent, employee, boss, church member, coworker, whatever it might be. Have you settled for mediocre? What more can you accomplish? What more could you do today to help your family, to help God's work, to develop yourself, to train for more future responsibility? Use each day. Think big. Among Mr. Armstrong's secrets of youthful vitality, he shared these: have the right goal, one that keeps you looking forward in anticipation. Keep your mind active and spry through continual education. Maintain good health through careful diet, good sleep, exercise, fresh air, and water. Keep a determined prod on yourself. He wrote, "Often when I feel like letting down, I have to use determination and force myself to keep driving on. Never give up. Never just lie down and quit. Many a time I've felt like it. Sometimes I've given up and quit at bedtime, but after a night's sleep, it's all a new ball game. And next morning, I'm plunging into it with renewed vigor and enthusiasm." Mr. Armstrong said the most important key to his youthful energy was his constant contact with God. He received God's help and protection countless times. And even more, he claimed God's promise in Isaiah 40. "The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, faints not, neither is weary. He gives power to the faint, and to them that have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, but they that wait upon the Eternal shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint." God wants you to have life more abundantly. He doesn't want you to think small. He doesn't want you half alive. He wants you to be full of life, to become all life, fire, wing, force. Think big. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, and Abraham Blondeau. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Thomas Jefferson: democracy will cease to exist when you take away from those who are willing to work and give to those who are not. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.